Hello, this is Rescue Dude of Mayor Risk LLC, and I am also the editor of the North Africa Journal. Today is the 21st of September 2020, and happy Monday to all of you. Well, this brief podcast is titled An Overstretched Egypt and the Seeds of Future Unrest. Now, Egypt has been working really hard to get back to a reasonable level of normalcy after COVID-19 has taken a big bite out of its economy. The highly controlled national media is full of positive stories, and certainly they need to be reported. For instance, last week, one of the state-controlled newspapers said flights between Armenia and Egypt have resumed as of the 17th of September. It's reported now that more than 250,000 tourists have flocked to the South Sinai and Red Sea resorts, and that is since Egypt reopened its tourism sector on the 1st of July. It's unclear who these 250,000 visitors are, but these are the numbers. There has been a great deal of tourism promotions, such as reports and essays on the village of Dahab, a former Bedouin village nestled between the Red Sea and the rocky red cliffs of the South Sinai. Well, I'm certainly in favor of Egypt promoting its tourism assets. The sector contributes 15% to the country's GDP, and has immeasurable contribution to the world's heritage. And who does not want to visit the pyramids, cruise on the Nile, and relax on the Red Sea? The cities and urban areas are teeming with culture, arts, food. For a long while, Egypt was the beacon of the Arab world on all fronts. The foreign media is also reporting some positive news. French news agency AFP reported on the resumption of camel racing in the South Sinai desert. But as there is a shortage of great news, we note a major focus on archaeological stories. For instance, CNN reported recently on, and I'm quoting here, mysterious mummies discovered in Egyptian well. These archaeological discoveries are all over the Egyptian media on the nonstop basis. Some media, however, have published a lot more honest assessments. Arab News, for example, reports that Egypt is losing about $1 billion a month. It states that, and I'm quoting, some regions have seen a 90% reduction in tourism. Again, this is not a problem specific to Egypt, as it is affecting all major tourism destinations worldwide. But it's important that the super positive news carried by state-controlled media and some of their foreign allies are vetted and verified. And so far, the excessive exuberance about the tourism sector in Egypt this fall season is clearly misplaced. In the business sector, many foreign investors have been enjoying Egypt for a number of logical reasons. The country managed to convince the IMF to lend it billions of dollars, so there is cash flowing around, although at a steep price for the Egyptian people. One of the consequences of an economy in turmoil but still attracting foreign speculators is the readjustment of the Egyptian currency. And because it has lost considerable value, foreigners are more than happy to buy Egyptian assets. Here is a very basic arithmetic. In late October 2016, one US dollar fetched roughly 8.8 Egyptian pounds. On January the 20th, 2017, or about 2 months later, a currency devaluation resulted in the US dollar exchange at 18.82 pounds. That was a 114% increase in the amount of Egyptian money that one single dollar can fetch. So what does that mean in real terms? Well, just imagine for a moment that there is a business for sale, a business, a building, a valuable piece of infrastructure for sale in a place like Cairo, Alexandria, or anywhere in Egypt, at the price of, let's make it pretty simple, 8.8 million pounds in late 2016, equivalent to, just for simplicity's sake, to $1 million. In early 2017, the depreciation of the pound now enabled people with dollars to buy that very same structure at about $480,000 instead of the $1 million mentioned earlier, or the equivalent of 50 cents roughly to a US dollar That would be half price. Now, because Egypt has been battered by political instability, the price of assets, even in the Egyptian currency, had to fall amid collapsing demand. So as foreign speculators with plenty of dollars, the benefits are double. Not only asset values have fallen in Egyptian pound, but they are now less than half price of what they were in US dollar terms. These are deep discounts that made many Wall Street investors and institutions that invest in sovereign debt happy to grab. But setting aside speculators, so-called foreign investors, and propagandists in Egypt who are eager to promote the image of a country that is far from the truth, how are Egyptians, and for those who really care about Egypt, coping and dealing with the realities on the ground and anticipating its stability and its long-term prospect? Let me begin with the problem that everyone in the world is facing, and that is the coronavirus epidemic. This week, the Egyptian government reauthorized the export of PPE, surgical masks, alcohol and its derivatives, used in a fight against the coronavirus in an effort to show that the situation is under control. But the virus is nowhere under control. In all, official and unaudited data suggest that the cumulative infection figure as of 17 September exceeded 101,000 people. Again, the figure is unaudited, so it is fair to assume that the number of infected people is several times that number. The death toll now nears 5,700. It probably surpassed it as of today, Monday. Just on the 17th of September, there were 160 more people infected based on government stats. And although peak deaths of 97 was recorded on June the 15th, the current daily rate of 17 was recorded on the 17th of September. Now, there's certainly a big drop, but the virus continues to weigh heavily on social and economic life in Egypt. As we headed towards spring and winter seasons, Egypt is not ruling out a so-called second wave, and there have been a great deal of preparations there. On the security front, Egypt remains a major flashpoint of instability. The country's security infrastructure is overstretched with multiple areas of conflict, from North Sinai bordering Israel and Palestine to the western desert bordering Libya, and of course into the big urban areas that harbor a great deal of resentment against the Sisi government. The threat level is so high that from late July to late August, Egypt's army killed more than 70 alleged jihadists in North Sinai, home of an insurrection against the government. The military also lost troops in the operation. On the 21st of July, another bloody confrontation in the Sinai region of Bir al-Abd ended with two soldiers and 18 alleged insurgents killed. On the western front of the country, things are also precarious. Presidential spokesman Bassem Radi stated back in July that during the past few years, the Egyptian armed forces have destroyed thousands of four-wheel drive vehicles on the Libyan border, assuming that those vehicles belong to terror groups. Radi even stated the figure of 10,000 vehicles, even suggesting that in all, they transported more than 40,000 terrorists and foreign fighters. The instability in Libya has certainly been a complicating factor, but Egypt has been part of the problem in solely supporting the eastern Libyan warlord Khalifa Haftar. Egypt should not expect to be spared if it decides to side with one faction on the Libyan conflict, or any conflict as a matter of fact. These are counterinsurgency operations that may or may not be publicized, but what is certain is that despite being overstretched on the domestic front, President Sisi made direct and repeated threats to open a new front within Libya proper with the aim of helping his protege Khalifa Haftar in confronting the Western government supported by Turkey. In mid-July, Sisi said that his country will not stand idle against threats to the national security of Egypt. Now, to project this opposition to Turkey into an Arab versus Turk conflict, He even stated that Egypt will not stand idle against threats to, and I'm quoting here, Arab countries. Sisi held a meeting with a select group of tribal leaders from eastern Libya who have been staunch supporters of Khalifa Haftar and who are keen on seeing a direct intervention from the Egyptian forces, with obviously the risk of throwing the entire region into another major conflict. In fact, his comments came days after the eastern-based Libyan parliament, naturally aligned with Haftar, gave in principle support to an Egyptian military intervention in the country. Regionally, Egypt has a big problem with its neighbors to the south, in particular Ethiopia, which has built a dam that allegedly threatens Egypt's water supply. As of August, negotiations on the so-called Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam have stalled due to persistent disagreements between Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan on a host of issues pertaining to the project. Of course, I would not fault Egypt for getting nervous about a structure that could starve it of water. After all, the Nile has always been a major source of stability and economic progress. But the issue is yet another flashpoint that adds to Egypt's problems and its long-term outlook. On the ground, the quality of life in Egypt has vastly deteriorated over the past years. The coronavirus has certainly amplified the state of misery facing millions of Egyptians. With limited resources for social help and aid, the Egyptian government is simply unable, perhaps unwilling, to provide any meaningful relief the poor and the vulnerable need, including thousands of street children. But what the Egyptian government has excelled at is to increase repression and prevent any form of reprieve to take place, helping build more pressure in what could become the most dangerous powder keg in the Arab world going forward. To begin with, personal liberties have completely vanished in Egypt. This summer, an Egyptian court handed a 15-year prison sentence to Ahmed Douma, a leading figure of the country's 2011 uprising. He was charged of clashing with the political police during a protest in Cairo. Egyptian police also arrested Sanaa Seif, a prominent activist, as part of an ongoing crackdown on dissidents. Such crackdown includes the arrest and sentencing to 2 years in prison of Hanin Hussam, Muaddal Adam, and three other women after they had posted footage on video sharing TikTok. They were charged with violating public morals. The Egyptian government is unforgiven and has been accused by human rights groups of abusing judicial harassment to make the lives of activists miserable. Egypt has apparently perfected the use of pre-trial detentions, which allow it to keep people in jail for up to 2 years without a trial. Human rights groups call this recycling judicial cases with the aim of prolonging the detention periods. In this Orwellian justice system, people are tried and retried over and over again in a permanent process of harassment. The Egyptian authorities don't limit their attacks to activists only. They even go after their families. Human rights groups, including Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International this summer, accused Egypt of harassing and intimidating the relatives of Mohammed Sultan, the son of a leading member of the now outlawed Muslim Brotherhood. The targeting of activists' families is considered by a rights group as reprisal raids, with many having been arrested already. The authorities in Egypt have essentially left no breathing room for the population to externalize their day-to-day pressure, essentially strengthening the powder keg that could explode in a form of social and political unrest. The rigidity of the Sisi regime and the military has reached such a high that even flying a kite is now illegal. Forget about using a laser drone or binoculars, even the simplest kites cannot be permitted. An Egyptian lawmaker called the kites a national security threat. No wonder why posting anything on Facebook could lead its authors to prison. For the people who do not dare question the authority of Sisi and his supporters, it is more about day-to-day survival. And then again, things are extreme. The country's basic infrastructure is continuously crumbling with the government unwilling to engage into a meaningful reconstruction and modernization program. This summer saw the collapse of a building on Qasr al-Nil Street near Tahrir Square in Cairo. Residents in the upscale Cairo suburb of Zamalek, close to embassies, were forced to evacuate when their buildings showed deep cracks. Still this summer, there have been transportation accidents, some deadly, such as the train derailing near Shubar al-Khaimah station or a boat sinking in a Nile River section of Bahira, killing four. So quality of life in Egypt has been going from bad to worse. So as we look into the future, how optimistic should we be about Egypt returning to its old glory as a leader of the Arab world? Sadly, the near exclusive focus of the Sisi reign is on security and on strengthening the military's grip on power and on repressing any form of dissent and opposition. In fact, most of the Egyptian economy is controlled by the military. The political opposition has been virtually dismantled and Sisi's loyalists are everywhere. Last month, For Egypt, an electoral list comprised of 11 parties made up of pro-Sisi candidates, won every electoral district, essentially taking over the upper house that was disbanded after the military coup against Islamic President Mohamed Morsi in 2013. Most Egyptians actually did not even bother to vote, with authorities reporting a turnout of just north of 14%. Sisi's pharaonic powers have been enshrined in a new constitution that boosted Sisi's control over the judiciary and granting the army even greater influence on political life. Sisi could officially be in power until 2030, and even retired army officers are now banned from running for president unless the military authorizes them. That guarantees that Sisi has no competition, even from within the military. So if we assume Sisi is in for at least 2030, and do not expect a miracle to take place, remember one thing: if history serves as a base to project the future, Sisi is not going to leave on his own. Mohamed Naguib resigned from office in November 1954 after Gamal Abdel Nasser launched a brutal campaign against him, accusing him of being a supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood. Jamal Abdel Nasser did not leave office willy-nilly either. He died of a heart attack in September 1970, essentially ruling over Egypt since November 1954, or 16 years. His replacement, Anwar al-Sadat, has had a miserable ending too, having been assassinated in October 1981. His replacement, Hosni Mubarak, also had a rather tumultuous ending, having been jailed and dragged into a prison in 2011. Now, Mubarak reigned for 30 years. Even the mighty Cleopatra reigned just 21 years. Mubarak eventually died in February 2020. His replacement, Mohamed Morsi, had the shortest tenure of all, just lasting a year, having been ousted by Field Marshal El-Sisi. So as you analyze the trajectory of Egyptian presidents, you can easily project that the current one is not going to leave office as if it were a democracy. And although the constitution now allows him to stay until 2030, I guarantee that the constitution will then be readjusted to allow a then 76-year-old Sisi to remain in power, if all goes well. So in closing, for those of you who work, live, and or follow Egypt and North Africa, or if you have staff working there and want to stay continuously updated about critical incidents taking place there, we're launching a mobile application called Shield and Alert. We are making it available to you and your staff free of charge for half a year. Just visit the app's website, shield-alert.com. That's shield-alert.com, with a minus sign between Shield and Alert. The app has been designed for the iPhone and now is also working on Android. If you need assistance, of course, we are a click away. Just use the analyst support link on the website and someone will talk to you. On that note, thank you for listening, and until the next podcast, goodbye.